The tales are depraved and spooky. The drinks they sip are boozy. Tune in and you'll hear a doozy. The Tipsy and Depraved.
Welcome back to Tipsy and Depraved, a morbid history podcast where we cover the darker and sometimes gruesome parts of history while we sip along to a drink we think matches the theme of the week. This week, we are drinking peach brandy sangria while we each take a turn telling a story about cannibalism. It's going to be a gruesome one. I'm Karina.
I'm Chelsea.
And I'm Jackie.
And this recipe for sangria we're drinking is a Jackie creation. She made this for us in the chaos right before her wedding, and it was delightful. Highly recommend. It is orange juice, red wine, peach brandy, and some sugar. I cheated. I bought a box sangria today, and I just poured my peach brandy in, eyeballed it. Let's see how this goes. But
it Jackie, has a delightful twist.
Yeah, Jackie made hers for real.
Jealous.
So here we go. Jealous. Yeah, easier for refills, that's for sure.
Yep, mine just too.
As Chelsea drinks a can of something that wasn't even that good because she made a face when she first had it.
It's just very strong. Instead of going to the store and buying stuff for sangria, I decided to take a nap because priorities. And
I feel that.
I feel that. Yeah, I had some beer in my fridge. I'm like, that'll do. And it's the Sweetwater Brewing Company. It's an IPA, and it's the 420 strain.
Oh, 420 is good.
Yeah, it's good, but like
it's strong. Yeah.
Yeah, it just kicked me in the mouth a bit when I took the first sip. It's like, oh, yeah, that's an IPA. Okay.
Yeah, 420 is really good.
Yeah. So I like it now. It's just that first initial taste was a bit of a mouth kicker.
It gets you in the taste buds.
Yes.
There you go.
I'm awake.
Yeah, now you are, at least. So I thought we'd start with a brief history of cannibalism. And when I say brief, fine. I mean like two sentences, and this is not going to cover literally.
People ate people. The end.
In case you don't know.
But for those of you who are curious, this is known to take place throughout most history and most corners of the world. Cultural significance and meanings are different. Sometimes in response to a famine, people have eaten people. It's also been used in symbolic ritualistic practices. Like for the Aztecs, cannibalism was motivated by belief that it was a way to commune with the gods. Whatever floats your boat. It's also been used as a form of medicine in many cultures. I mean, we talked about mamiya, which is my favorite thing in the world, which is truly disgusting. But if you didn't listen to that episode, it's ground up mummified remains meant to be consumed by people. And it was used well into 20th century. So not okay. Super recent. We're eating people.
What was the stuff that was in it? Was it like some sort of tar, right?
Yeah. It was some sort of tar. I forget the name of it, but that was what was believed to be
I think it's an interesting flex that instead of just like making a pill out of like the tar powder or something, it's like, hey, the tar is already on this person. Let's just ground up them and eat them. Like,
the sad part was that they ran out and they just started using Europeans. So they weren't even Egyptian mummies. They just started using random people. So like,
you.
Supply and demand.
Medicine.
Yeah, basically. I mean, and there's also like, I was reading about oils from hair follicles, powdered blood to treat epilepsy. Like, people would just use anything.
People were creative back then.
Yeah.
A plus for creativity, right?
Yeah, for sure. This week, I am diving into the story of Issei Sagawa. I hope I'm saying Issei right. And our story begins in Paris, France, and not Paris, Texas.
Oh. What a shame.
Same place.
It's always the first Paris I think of. Texas.
On June 11, 1981, Rene Harfel, a 24-year-old Dutch student, was shot and killed. After 48 hours, Sagawa emerges from his apartment and gets a taxi carrying two large suitcases and tells the driver to take him to a nearby park. When he arrives at the park, he's struggling to drag the two suitcases he brought with him to the nearby lake, which kind of got people's attention. He decides to rest on a bench for whatever reason and falls asleep.
Man, those suitcases were heavy. Leave him alone. Yeah, he's working hard.
The dude's only 32. How hard could it have been? Like,
that you I'm 33, and sometimes stairs are rough. Okay.
Like, stairs are rough.
Oh my god. Well, anyway, he falls asleep and he wakes up to find this old man trying to open the suitcase. The old man is successful and starts screaming his head off. And when this guy starts to scream, Sagawa just stands up and walks away. Cool.
Oh, okay.
Sound logic. I do the same.
Yeah.
I'm like, shit, I got caught. I'm just going to go now.
I'm just going to leave. There you go, this way. You keep screaming. Good job. Yeah.
Not mine. Bye.
Oh, shit. All
right. Right. Oh, that's frightening. Oh, never seen that before. Gotta go.
Who put this here?
Yeah, baby. My stars.
Let me go. So
clutch the pearls a little bit.
My hands.
Apparently, and a witness has described him as a well-dressed Asian man, too. So, like, he could have played it off.
Just asleep on a bench with two suitcases.
Yeah, he could have played it off. So, Olivier Foll is the lead investigator on this case, and he gets called, obviously, to the scene of these two suitcases, and they take the body to the morgue, and what police describe as striking was that parts of her flesh had been removed from her body, and they quickly figured out that she had been shot in the back of the head at close range, and because she had been so badly mutilated, she was hard to identify, so they didn't know who she was at this point. All they knew was that she was a young woman who had been raped post-mortem and had chunks of her missing.
Yikes.
Yeah. So, thanks to the description of a short Asian man from the park, the police had this, like, one lead. They found the taxi driver who took him to the park, and less than 48 hours after they got the prime suspect, which was Sagawa, he's a 32-year-old at this time, 4'9", and he immediately confesses. And this is a small man.
Yeah, I am taller than this man. 4'9"?
Yeah.
That's like...
itty bitty.
That's little, yeah.
Itty bitty. Like, Chelsea, where would I don't even know where this man would be.
Wait, how
in comparison
tall
to your height. Like, I don't know what I am. I think I lied on my license, but I'm definitely over 5 foot.
Yes, you are.
I think I lied on my license.
It's like, who actually measures themselves? Do you know what I mean? Like,
no, yeah.
I don't know. The last time I was measured, I was 18 and at the pediatrician.
Yeah, I don't remember the last time I was, like, officially measured. I feel like I've gotten shorter over time, though. Compacting down.
Well, that actually does happen. It's not a very nice reason, but that does happen.
Yeah.
Anyway, so this is a small man. It comes into play later that he's a small man.
How did he shoot her behind the head then?
I will get to that. She was seated.
Okay.
By the way. This is, and Renee Hartfelt is Dutch, so she's, I would at least think, somewhat taller than he is.
Yeah.
I feel like this is a bias. My head immediately went to, like, a 6 foot beautiful lady.
Oh, that's kind of what he's attracted to, too, is, like, tall Western women.
Ah, shit. Gotta go.
You would definitely be a target in this situation.
Yep, brunettes too.
Oh, shit.
Checking all the boxes.
So So they got so they apprehend this guy, and he's not what they expect from the murder and the corpse that they have in the morgue.
That's fair. When
they enter the apartment, they find evidence of cannibalism. The fridge is full of human flesh. They also find plates of cooked human with condiments. They
specially noted mustard. I was gonna say, gotta have the dipping sauce.
It was like
barbecue sauce.
Lady tenders.
Oh god. But the important thing was they also found Renee's ID, and that's how they identified her. But what makes this crazy is not the cannibalism, but the fact that he never stood trial. He is now 72, living under a false name in Japan. He's done many interviews, written books about himself and everything.
Why is he under a false name if he's just talking about it all willy-nilly?
I have no idea how the logic works, man. I'm just here. It's like a lot too. We'll get there. He was born in 1949 to a wealthy... Oh, hello. That was scary.
I saw the door really.
Ghost.
No, I just assumed it was your husband.
Ghost. Ghost. Oh god.
It's not going first now that you have your wedding dress on the door. It's just like this white human figure too.
I feel like I should turn on the light. Oh god.
Yeah, the situation you have right now is very like
I'm going out
haunted
to turn
house.
On the light.
Like, is this the what movie was it? Like the Paranormal, like 4 or something, when they're just on like the webcams the whole time.
Yeah.
Love it.
Woo! Only halfway there.
We got this.
It's okay.
We're off to an awesome start.
Okay, peach brandy, nothing to sneeze at.
Sneeze at?
You never heard that expression?
No.
Wait, really? I guess that's an East Coast.
Is that an East Coast thing?
It might be an East Coast thing.
Nothing to sneeze at? Like, why would you sneeze at it?
I don't know. It's just an expression, Chelsea.
I don't even know how to say the expression.
No. It's just something my parents used to say.
Yeah.
I've never heard this before.
Oh my god. Okay. I can't even function right now.
I'm gonna eat what's the greatest soup.
Well, it's nothing to sneeze at, apparently.
Okay. Who's now on? That I got the paranormal situation under control. Here we go. Okay, so to clarify all of this, he's born in 1949 to a wealthy family, and he's described as being a small, frail boy, because he was born prematurely and like almost died at birth, so we find significance in this. I thought it was weird, because he tells a story that his uncle used to play with him and his younger brother, pretending to be an ogre, and that would chase them to try to eat them, and, like, even with a pot of soup to, like, cook them. Like, what kind of uncle is this guy?
You guys never played like ogre food before?
No, never.
Maybe
played
it's a West
ogre
Coast
food.
Thing.
Oh god! But this guy does a lot of interviews and written, like I said, many books about himself. So he already talks about like how in his teens and his early 20s. He already had cannibalistic urges. And just to remind you, he murdered this girl at 32. Yuck. So he fantasizes about Western women, particularly brunettes. And Sagawa thought he had to do it, and he was just waiting for some sort of like sign that it was time to eat somebody.
Is he one of those like missionary like killers where it's like he needs the sign from God, or like he's fulfilling like some sort of purpose?
It's not even God. Like, it's just some sort of sign from the universe. Oh. Like, he doesn't ever actually mention that. Like, it's nothing religious or anything.
Yeah.
know.
There's that serial killer in California who murdered people because he thought he was preventing an apocalypse or like an earthquake.
That sounds like schizophrenia.
Yep.
A
little
bit. I think that's what they decided he had.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
Sounds accurate.
If my abnormal psych has anything, any lasting effect on me, that's what that sounds like. So he said his first sign was when a German girl moved into his neighborhood. Mind you, it's 1950s Japan, 1960s, I guess, at this point, because he's in his early 20s or late teens at this point. Actually, I think early 20s from the timeline. So he's in his early 20s. This German girl moves into their neighborhood in Japan. And his idea was not to kill her, but to sneak into her room and eat part of her butt cheek. And the tools he decided on to endeavor on this quest, an umbrella and a Frankenstein mask. I'm not sure what he was going to do with the umbrella. I understand the mask. Like, Chelsea's face. So, needless to say, like, umbrella aside, he gets into her room somehow through the window. But he's a little clumsy and his knee, like, touches her. So she wakes up and, like, immediately starts screaming.
Did you think that she wouldn't wake up when he started eating her ass? Like,
I don't know what the logic is here.
And not in, like, a sexual way of eating the ass. Just, like, om nom nom eating.
Like, literally,
this is my snack for the night.
Like, he brought an umbrella. Like, I don't know what logic you expect here. Like,
maybe it's like a get back. You don't know me like that. I don't know.
Like,
pushing her back with the umbrella.
I don't know what his plan was here, that she wouldn't wake up. Like, I wouldn't even wake up if somebody touched me like that, though. If, like, somebody just bumped me, I wouldn't wake up. So, like, the fact that this girl woke up was like, oh, good. She saved herself,
yeah.
Basically.
Yeah.
Which she does, because he tries to escape, but she was stronger than he was and got the jump on him and grabbed his arms.
That's crazy.
So,
oh my god.
So she gets the jump on him and he is arrested for attempted rape, but let free thanks to a payment his father made to the woman.
Was he going to rape her with the umbrella?
No, I don't think so. We are not sure.
They probably just assumed he was going to rape her, not eat her.
Yeah. Yeah. The assumption was that he was...
Yeah, when like a guy breaks into a girl's house, you don't feel like, oh. Yeah.
Snack. Yeah,
true.
Yeah, the first thing isn't snack, it's rape, so that's what he's charged with. And his father is, like, deeply disturbed about this thing in the first place, and he sends him to a psychiatrist, where he was deemed extremely dangerous, but, of course, they did nothing. So, great.
Like, I get it, and I don't get it at the same time. The, like, you can't lock someone up before they commit a crime. You can't.
Yeah.
That's the part that frustrates me so much when, like, this is gonna be an off tangent right now. But, like, when women, like, have stalkers and stuff, the police can't do anything until the person commits a crime. Like, either, like, assaults her or something like that. Until then, they can't do it, even if he's, like, threatening stuff. Like, it's just bizarre.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a weird loophole in there.
Yeah.
But, like, he's not even monitored by psychiatrists at this point, even, like, by being deemed extremely dangerous. Like, there's just no point to being deemed extremely dangerous at this point, really. Because 5 years after, in 1977, he leaves for Paris, and he is studying for his doctorate in literature. He describes a few of his classmates as very beautiful, and Renee is, like, one of the women who caught his attention and, sadly, is one of the only students who, like, invited him to go out and hang out. And, of course, he's in love with her, and he's thinking that because he's in love, in his twisted mind, he thought he had to eat her. So, that's nice. He describes his personality as, like, being swallowed up by his obsession, which I find deeply disturbing. Like, when and this is, like, his words. I'm, like, watching video of him being interviewed to look at this, to, like, research for this. It's, like, super creepy. Like, I should have started drinking way before we started the pod because it was, like, super disturbing to me. So she's one of the only people who invite him out. So he's immediately in love and he starts planning. After weeks of planning, he finally invites her over to his apartment to read some German literature. He like writes her this whole letter saying like, he's so sorry, but he would love her help on recording this for class in German. And he plans everything out. He even planned the part where he was going to shoot her from behind because he was going to, he set up a desk for her to record the poem, the German poem at. So she's sitting at the desk starting to record the poem. Of course, he even chooses a poem about cannibalism. And mm-hmm. he decides even like that his first bite would be of her butt.
It's a good meaty area.
It's a meaty area, yes. Oh, God. It's so gross. Like, he, well,
he's an ass man,
but he's like, he talks later on, like, I'll get into it, but he's like, talks to police and like, I won't even get into it because it was super gross. But he, like,
that poor girl, though, like, she's just being a nice person.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like, they mm-hmm. went out to dinners and everything. Like, she even writes to her parents saying, like, how much she enjoys his company and like she made a friend. Like, terrible.
That's so sad.
Yikes. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, poor baby.
And like he talks to police about like he's not like all there, obviously, but he like talks to police about like which parts are like the best even to eat. It's like so gross.
Oh.
Anyway,
he spends did he have to eat though?
48 hours with the corpse.
Whoa.
Yeah, so he spends 48 hours with the corpse. He took photos of what he did in different phases of her dismemberment. We already talked about how he raped her at one point as well. And police even have an audio recording of the murder.
Oh my God.
Why in the world, with all of this physical evidence, is this dude free?
Right.
So, I will get there. It is annoying as shit. Police were surprised by his behavior because when they arrested him, he didn't even hesitate to give them like all the horrible details about what he did. He was like almost proud of it. And after 34 months, after he was taken into custody, he's released. He was all over French and Japanese newspapers. He seemed almost boastful and like proud of himself for what he did. And despite that, he was so obviously guilty, he goes free, and he does so with the help of the French government.
Mm.
Okay, so in France, it's like written into the penal code that you have to have in these criminal cases a psychological examination. First off, his examination takes over a year to complete. So all while he's in custody, while he's going through this psychological examination, they describe him as oversensitive, hung up on his height, emotionally cold, and self-satisfied.
Oh, me.
That's disturbing. Don't say that. But they deem all this to say is like they took over a year to say that this dude is insane and they transfer him indefinitely to this French mental hospital. So now is the time when once again his father comes to help him and he employs this powerful lawyer who influences the French government. And asks the government that he be transferred to a Japanese mental health facility so that he can be cured there. Because it's not fair to the French government to be asking their taxpayers to pay for this Japanese citizen to get mental health care. And the French only ask that he never come back to France. So as soon as he sets foot on Japanese soil, he's literally, the sad truth, he's like a free man.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's fucked up, man.
And it's so this like, is
we
all
just
over
don't
the
want
media
to deal
too.
With this. Go back to Japan, please. Like,
yeah, just well, don't come
like,
back.
Like, they would have left him there if this dude didn't get hired and, like, influence them to really go back
That's
to
crazy.
Japan. Like, this lawyer that his father hired, like, talked them into it. Because otherwise they would have left him there in that mental hospital. And thanks to his father's influence, when he steps foot on Japan, his father asks the hospital for him to enter the hospital so that the press would see him going into the hospital, you know, so that people would see him going there, going to get treatment, and, like, an uproar wouldn't come about this, because this was all over the, the newspapers. Like, cannibalism thing was all over the place in the early 80s. And after 18 months in the hospital, dude checks himself out, and he has lived in Japan outside of Tokyo, just outside of Tokyo in a little city, for ever since. He's 72 now. Reporters and documentarians even visit his apartment. He's unemployed and lives alone. He wrote In the Fog in the mid-80s and then wrote 18 more books about his crime. And he's, like, appeared in every form of media in Japan, even a columnist in a newspaper. And he's still kicking.
And making money off of it.
That pisses me off that he murdered a sweet, precious girl who just wanted to be his friend. And then he makes money off of it for the rest of his life.
He is the creepiest person to hear talking. Like, he does interviews all the time. Like, literally, it's one documentary I was watching was, like, he's talking about his love for classical music and, like, showing them around his apartment. It's weird.
Oh, no.
And he, In the Fog, is apparently deeply disturbing, and, like, it's sold out. And that's what, like, spurred him to write more, and, like, he was on. And everything is just about the one murder. It's nothing, like, apparently it's nothing new. Like, I haven't read everything that he's done, but, like, apparently it's all about the one murder. And, like, it's fictional. Some of it's fictional, but, like, it's so obviously what he did to that girl.
Right.
That's so sad.
Yeah.
And then he was in the mental hospital for 18 months?
The mental hospital in Japan he was in for 18 months. I didn't get a chance to see how long he was in the hospital in France.
Did they have any, like, deeming him worthy of society or something? Like, when he
No, left? Dude checked that's... himself out. Like, how do you check yourself out?
That's crazy.
Aren't there checks and balances? Even so, even so, like, he'd never committed a crime in Japan. So to them, he...
Yeah, they can't do
he's anything. He's innocent. Wasn't,
yeah, like, innocent. And he was never actually tried in France. He was never, like, in a... Like, his case never went to trial. He was under psychological evaluation and then deemed insane and then went to the mental hospital. So, like, he never stood trial for any of this. So, never was technically tried in a court of law.
That's so sad for the girl and her family.
Yeah, like, apparently the family has never commented. Yeah, the family has never commented on any of this. Like, apparently they just, like, stay away from the whole thing. And, like, he did some, like, this whole thing, like, fucked up his family, too. Because he has a younger brother, and his mother tried to commit suicide after this. And, like, his father was, like, never the same. And, like, his brother went to mental health issues, too. I mean, I would, too, if my sibling was eating people.
Yeah.
Ate one person. It was enough.
Like, that's crazy.
Yeah. And his parents died in, like, 2005. Like, this is rather recent.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that is the cannibal who walks free.
You guys ready?
Ready.
I hope this goes well because I've never done the bullet points before for telling a story. I usually, like, write it out all out verbatim how I say it.
Oh, yeah. I wrote it all verbatim like I say it, too.
No, I'm the bullet point.
So I'm trying something new and hopefully it goes okay.
Okay.
We'll see.
We're here for you.
We got you.
Thank you. And I like to start off that I say English words very poorly, and this takes place in Uruguay, so apologies for any pronunciations that go wrong.
Oh dear, even sometimes I can't get the Uruguayan accent in Spanish, so.
What's the accent?
It's a little different from what I'm used to. I mean, I have Caribbean Spanish, so Uruguayan Spanish is a little different. It's like every country has their own kind of flavor.
Yeah, yeah, no, a little spice.
Yeah.
Okay. So hold on. Let me take a sip before I start talking because I can't drink when I...
you can't drink when you're talking? It's a new discovery we made today. I almost made her spit out her drink. Now she's dying.
I tried to talk with while drinking.
We already discussed this. It's not possible.
It does not work.
I had to test it out. Look, I'm a scientific lady. Okay, so if you couldn't have guessed it when I said that mine takes place in Uruguay, I guess technically it doesn't take place in Uruguay, but it starts off in Uruguay. Today I'm going to be talking to you about the Uruguayan Air Force Flight 571 disaster, also known as the Miracle of the Andes.
Oh.
Oh, boy.
I feel like I've heard this one before.
Once I get into it, you probably will. Like, I didn't know the details, but once I started reading it, I'm like, this sounds really familiar. Yeah. So it'll probably just sound familiar. So on October 12th of 1972, the Old Christians Club rugby team boarded Flight 571 from Montevideo, Uruguay.
Montevideo.
Thank you. Anytime you know how to pronounce something, just hop in there.
I got you.
Thank you. To Santiago, Chile. Due to the storm front over the Andes, they had to stop overnight in Mendoza, Argentina. The stop in Mendoza changed the flight path. If the flight took off from Mendoza, there was a straight path to where they were heading, Santiago. But the peak of the Andes was too high for the plane that they're in. Like, it exceeded the max altitude. So they decided to create a U-shaped path to safely go over the Andes and go through some of the passes. On the morning of the 13th, conditions over the Andes had not improved, but they were expecting to improve later that afternoon. So the flight was delayed until 2:18 p.m. During the flight, the clouds obscured the mountains and landmarks. Like, it was bad. No one could see anything. They were flying blind.
Never good.
So after flying through the Planchon Pass, a minute later, the pilot radioed that they were a minute away from Curico, which is usually an 11-minute flight from the path. So a minute afterwards, they're like, we're about to pass Curico. And then 3 minutes after that radio, the pilot radioed that they had passed Curico and were turning north. So in 4 minutes after they passed the flight, they said they already passed Curico, but that is usually an 11-minute flight after the pass.
So too soon. Yeah.
Too soon.
Okay.
The air traffic control in Santiago, believing them to have already passed Curico because they were just listening to the transmissions and were talking with them, informed them to start their descent and to descend by 11,500 feet.
Oh my God.
Damn.
Yeah. You can see where this is going.
Yeah. Nowhere good. Nowhere good.
Yes. Upon the descent, severe turbulence caused alarm, but the rugby players were joking it off until they saw the mountain suddenly appear outside their window. Survivor Nando Parado said that he remembered them hitting a downdraft that made the plane drop several hundred feet. When he saw the mountains outside the window, he realized that that was when the pilots must have seen the black ridge that was rising dead ahead of them. The pilot put maximum power to gain altitude to the point that the plane was nearly vertical with the mountain. At 3:34 p.m., the pilot was able to bring the nose of the plane over the mountain, but the tail hit the peak of the mountain. So it just like hit the tail hit.
Oh, God.
It is believed by reviewing the crash site that the plane struck the mountain a total of 3 times.
Yikes.
Oof. The first was when the tail clipped the mountain. This tore the tail cone off the plane, including 3 rows of seats in the back of the plane. 5 people, including the navigator and the steward, died during this hit. Yep.
Wow. That's crazy. That's what's left of it.
Yeah. There's not great. Wings. No, I get into the wings. What happens to the wings right now? Oh. But during the first hit with the tail, 5 people, including the navigator, were sucked out of the back of the plane and they died. So, and they're lost. I don't think they found them.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
The next collision tore off the right wing of the plane. The aircraft continued forward a few more seconds before the left wing struck an outcropping, which tore off the wing. This hit made the propeller slice through the fuselage, which caused 2 more passengers to fall out of the plane and die. The plane, now without a tail on both of its wings, flew straight through the air at 220 miles per hour for about 2,379 feet before it hit a snowbank. The crash into the snowbank killed 4 people on impact. The plane rested on top of a glacier in the Andes Mountains. The glacier at the time did not have a name, but is now known as the Glacier of Tears.
It's fitting.
Wow.
Yes. In the initial crash, the following people died. Lieutenant Ramon Saul Martinez, Arvido Ramirez, Gaston Castamea, Alejo Hone, Guido Magre, Daniel Shaw, Carlos Valida. Carlos actually survived the fall, but fell into such deep snow that he was asphyxiated. Wow. His body was found by the survivors on December 14th.
Oh, God.
And that's just a hint of how long they were up there, because remember, they crashed on October 13th.
Holy crap, I did not realize that.
Yes. Dr. Francisco Nicola died. His wife, Esther Nicola, died. Eugenia Parado died. Fernando Vasquez and one of the pilots, Paradas. The other pilot, Lugaria, I think his name's Lugaria, I'm going with it, was injured and trapped in the cockpit. He knew that he was not in good shape and asked passengers to locate his pistol and shoot him.
Wow.
All the passengers declined.
Oh, I would decline too. I can't. Yes,
me too. Yeah. I'm like, I'm so sorry.
Just give me the gun then.
Yeah. Out of the 45 people on the plane, only 33 remained alive after the crash, but most of them were critically injured. When they hit the snowbank, the front couple of seats went, like, crushed forward, so there's a lot of people with broken legs.
Yikes.
Yeah, because they went into, like, the behind the cockpit area, and it just, like, accordioned them.
Yeah. Ugh.
Yes. 2 med students were on board and were quickly able to treat wounds and assess the damage.
Wow,
and,
that's lucky.
Get that medical advice. Search and rescue went into effect an hour after the crash, but due to the location of the craft, they could not locate them. Survivors said that they saw 3 planes fly overhead, but were unable to get their attention. 8 days later, the search and rescue was called off. And the way that the plane was situated, it was so snowy and the plane was white. So it just, everything blended in.
Oh,
yeah. And also remember too, that the pilot radioed and said they were further ahead and not where they actually were. So they were supposed to be already past Carico. I forget where it was. And they were not past that yet.
Yikes.
Wow.
During the first night, 5 more people died. Pilot Lugaria, he died. Francisco Abel, Graciela Mariani, Felipe Marquin, and Julio Martinez Lamas. Temps during this time reached negative 22 degrees because in October, they are still in their winter because they're in the southern hemisphere. Yes. The survivors had to ration what food they were able to find. The food that they did find, they had 8 chocolate bars, 1 tin of mussels, 3 small jars of jam, 1 tin of almonds, a few dates, candies, dried plums, and several bottles of wine. And at this time, too, because it is high up in the Andes, there are no animals and there's no, like, there's no plants. Like, it's just snow and mountain.
Yeah.
So there's nothing for them to forage and eat.
Yeah.
Within a week on the mountain, the rations were gone. The survivors attempted to eat parts of the airplane. They would eat the cotton out of the seats and, like, other aspects of the plane.
Yeah.
So, as we've seen in My Strange Addiction, it doesn't work out too well if you eat those things.
Ugh.
After a little while, they realized that, you know, if they didn't find a source of food, they were going to die. So the people who survived, they all gave permission for those who lived to eat their bodies so that they could survive.
If they died?
Yeah. They're like, if I die, you can eat me. Like, that's fine. So you can survive.
Oh, God.
Oh, my God.
Yes. All the passengers.
That's so upsetting.
Yeah. All of the passengers were Roman Catholic, and they feared damnation over the choices to stay alive. many passengers justified their choice from the Bible verse in John 15:13, which is, no man hath greater love for love than this, that he laid down his life for his friends. And they used that verse to justify, you know, eating people.
Yeah.
It's not survival. I think, you know, just surviving survival, is justification.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, absolutely. You know, when you're deeply religious.
Yeah.
No, it has to not be
the greatest. Something.
Yeah.
That must have, like, hurt them. I mean.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. This was a rugby team. Then they brought their family and friends, like, on the plane with them.
Yeah. This is family and friends that they're eating. Like.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Like, people had their wives and their kids with them on the plane. Not
that
it makes
it any better that you're eating a stranger. You know what, right. I mean?
Like, yeah, but, like, you level. Know someone. Like you've been to their house and broke bread, yeah, and, you know, whatever.
Like, yeah.
So, and it just gets worse for them. On October 29th, 17 days after the crash, an avalanche struck the aircraft, immediately killing 8 people.
Oh,
the 8. Yeah, they were sleeping in the plane when it happened, because remember, it's still middle of winter for them. And so the only source of shelter was the plane.
Right. Yeah.
So they were sleeping in there when the avalanche struck, killing 8 people. And they were Enrique Platero, Liliana Methal, Gustavo Nikolic, Daniel Maspons, Juan Mendendez, Diego Storm, Carlos Roque, and Marcelo Perez. The plane was buried under the snow for 3 days. All the survivors of the avalanche were trapped in the airplane with the 8 people who died. Day 3 is when they decided to start eating the people who died in the avalanche. They eventually were able to tunnel to the surface, but when they tunneled out, they were in the middle of a blizzard, so they had to go back in and wait out the blizzard in the
airplane. Oh my God.
It's freaking traumatizing, man.
Yep.
Yeah. After they were able to start exploring the area, because they realized that they needed to figure out how they were going to stay alive, so they started exploring the area, and not much came from it. And then on November 5th, Arturo Noguera died, and then 3 days later, Rafael Inchevarin died, and they both died from gangrene. So they had really bad infections from wounds that they had.
From the winds, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Numa Turcotti, who had trouble with their new diet, died on day 60 on the mountain on December 11th. So,
oh my God.
Yes. Jeez. She weighed, I think it was a she, she weighed 55 pounds when she died.
Holy
wow.
Shit.
Wow.
Yes. The survivors decided that they need to go to leave to find help, because obviously, like, they're running out of options. You know, most of the wounds, like, that were kind of crippling them, they were able to start, you know, moving past that. So the 3 most fit people decided to venture off to find some help.
Oh my God.
They hiked for almost 10 days. And on the 9th day, they found a group of 3 men on horseback across the river. So there was this huge river, and, you know, they were shouting at them for a while before, like, they could actually hear them because the river was so loud.
Yeah.
So the survivor, I think it was Parado, he wrote a message and flung it across the river to the people on horseback. His note read, "I come from a plane that fell on the mountains. I'm Uruguayan. We have been walking for 10 days. I have a wounded friend up there. In the plane, there are still 14 injured people. We have to get out from here quickly, and we don't know how. We don't have any food. We are weak. When are you going to come fetch us? Please, we cannot even walk. Where are we?"
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So the next day, the guys on horseback, obviously they couldn't cross the river and, like, pick them up. So they went and found help. The group that went hiking, they were picked up on December 21st. And then on December 22nd, the first 7 people were rescued off of the mountain from the plane crash. And then on December 23rd, the last 7 people that were still alive were picked up off the mountain.
Holy crap. Wow.
Yes. So in total, it was 16 out of 45 people.
And 33 survived the crash.
Initially, right. 33 Initially. People survived. And then by the time they were rescued, there were 16 still alive.
I almost think that 33 to 16 is the worst.
Yeah.
Part. Yeah, definitely. Because that is people just like dying from wounds over time and
in front of you.
Yeah.
Versus, I mean,
on impact,
it's all terrible, but like, you know what I'm getting
at. It's more traumatizing, I feel like.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Watching it happen.
Yeah, but these are people in front of your face.
Yeah, and they're your family and friends.
They
your
know. Family yeah, and friends, yeah.
They played on a rugby team together. Like, when you're on a sports team, like, you are close with these people. So, yeah, not the greatest. Yeah.
I do remember this. It's the book. Nando Parado wrote a book about it. And his mother and his younger sister. My God.
Yeah, his mother and his younger sister died in the crash. I think they died in the first week after the plane crashed.
That's terrible.
Ugh.
And he was in a coma for 3 days.
That's wow. Insane.
Yeah.
There's a lot of pictures online, too. Like, they took pictures of themselves after the crash.
Yeah, can you imagine? I mean, they didn't have anything going on up there either. Like, it's just them, snow, and their crashed airplane. Like, for 72 days, they were up on the mountain.
Yeah, I don't even know what I would do in that situation.
Yeah, I don't know either. There are several people who said that, like, they had to remain hopeful, like, when... because apparently, I think they had, like, a little handheld radio. And so they can hear, like, the updates that, like, people were searching for them. And they also heard when they stopped searching for them.
Oh, that's the worst part.
Yes.
That's horrible.
And so a couple of the people were like, well, this is good news. And, like, people were, like, freaking out, like, well, how is this good news? And the person was like, well, that means we're going to get ourselves off the mountain. Like, so we're going to take care of this. And so, like, they were just really good, optimistic people, like, that got stuck in a shitty situation.
Yeah, that's probably how they survived, though, honestly.
Yeah. On December 26th, so this is just a couple days after they were rescued, the cannibalism was revealed to the public. Someone took a picture of a half-eaten human leg and put it front and center on a newspaper.
That's fucked up. Come on.
And then remember how I said a lot of the people who were Roman Catholic and were very terrified of being damned? They went to church and they confessed to the things that they did.
Mm-hmm.
The Catholic priest heard the survivors' confessions and told them that they were not damned for the cannibalism, given the extreme nature of the survival situation.
Good.
So, he did, like, the forgiveness thing. And so hopefully that helped them. I mean, you don't really have a choice at that point.
Yeah. Hopefully that helped them move on, though.
Yes. So all the bodies remained at the crash site. 13 bodies were untouched, while another 15 were mostly skeletal. So those were the ones that were probably
eaten.
Yeah.
12 men and a priest were transported to the crash site on the 18th of January of 1973 to bury all of the dead. Family members were not allowed to attend. One of the fathers of one of the victims wanted to bury his son at home, but he wouldn't, the government wouldn't let him go up to the mountain and get the body. So he did his own expedition went up there and got his son. And then he tried to go to a hotel
with his dead son.
And he was arrested. Yeah. He was arrested for grave robbing.
Oh my God.
And so, but a federal judge and the local mayor intervened to obtain his release. And then he later obtained legal permission to bury his son at home.
Wow. I wonder why they wouldn't let him.
Like, you just let the guy do it.
Why wouldn't they let them?
I don't know. It doesn't go into the detail on it. Even if they paid
for them.
It might have been, like, dangerous or, like, just, I don't know. I don't know the culture or anything, like, if it's, like, disturbing, like, places of rest, like, if they were there. I don't know.
I don't know. That seems odd. Like, if he was willing to pay for it, you know?
Yeah.
Right. I understand, like, maybe the government doesn't want to pay for the helicopter for them to be
bring removed the bodies.
Respectfully. Yeah, like, but if he pays for it himself.
Yeah, let him.
Let him right? do it.
Do it.
That's but crazy. That's the miracle of the Andes.
Ooh. Did they have backlash for the newspaper article? Because that, I feel like I just survived this traumatic experience.
Right, like let people that be in the
society
story.
Are shunning me and letting that be the story.
Yeah, so the survivors, after like it was announced that they had, you know, were eating the deceased, they held a press conference. And there is a lot of backlash initially, but once they started explaining like the dire situations that they were in and the sacrifices that they made, they the outcry diminished and families were more understanding of, you know, what they went through.
Yeah.
So.
So this guy is the same age as, almost the same age, 71. He was born the same year as Sagawa.
That's crazy.
The guy who wrote the book. That's an odd quinky dink.
Right. Wait, what year was Sagawa born again?
1949. Yeah, 72. And it says Parado walked 44 miles for that to get help.
Yeah.
That's insane. 44 miles?
In 10 days.
That's.
And it was mostly uphill.
Pretty good time.
You're not healthy at this point. You're like,
no. This is like
44 miles and you're
day
not healthy.
70. Like, he's not doing well. They can't be doing well. They've only been eating each other. Like, it's.
Yeah.
They can't be doing well.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
You've had snow and people.
Yeah. Negative 22 degree weather elements, like snow blindness. I mean, can you imagine being on top of a mountain where it's like you don't have sunglasses, you don't have anything. It's just the sun on snow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's painful.
Yeah. Like you have nowhere to look or you can go spend time in the plane with the dead bodies.
Yikes.
Which in itself is traumatic.
Yeah.
I don't know what I'd do in that situation. I hope that I'd probably be one of the people who just fell out of the plane.
Yeah.
Ugh, God.
Yep.
Yeah. The severe trauma and therapy you would have to go through after that.
Yeah.
Yeah, just suck me out.
Just suck me out. Oh, God. I don't even know. I'm more inclined to survive, but, like, I don't even know. Like, I would be on the first plane eating. I would be the first vegetarian.
Yes.
But if it's a snow-capped mountain, like, I don't even know what I would do.
There's no options. There's no
I know.
Food.
Like,
yeah.
They were on a glacier. It's not even like it's...
not even dirt underneath.
Yeah.
No, there's nothing.
Yeah, all my like, disaster scenarios have a tropical island involved. I think that's like 90s television.
I can have some television fish. Has, like, I'm fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
The nanny has ingrained that in me. Do you remember that?
Fran Drescher?
Yeah, the nanny, Fran Drescher, and when she finally gets with, oh my God, Mr. Sheffield.
Mm-hmm.
On their honeymoon, they get like stranded on a tropical island and they have to make their own shelter. This is what 90s television has taught me. So that's like my
that's
version
what stuck with you.
I'm roughing it. Oh, oh God.
So yeah, so my cannibalism story was the fight for survival, not out of
I would
any
say
other need.
Less as disturbing.
As more wholesome than
murder. It's as wholesome as wholesome cannibalism
like
can go.
Yeah, it's about as wholesome as you can get when it comes to cannibals.
Yep. Wholesome cannibals. That's the title of our episode.
It's the title of this episode. I will hear no other responses.
Oh my God. You're all welcome. Thank well, let's you. Bring it on back to some terrible people then.
Woo! I'm glad I changed mine up. I was about to do a serial killer.
I'll bring it back to that.
I think we needed that break.
Yeah, it was like
in the middle.
It was dark, but it was like it had a happy ending. Kind of.
It's the wholesomeness of cannibalism.
Yeah. Somebody lived. Somebody lived.
It was a survival story.
Yes.
survival story.
It was out of pure necessity. You didn't have any
I'm sorry's.
Yeah. No.
No. Not at
just
all.
Sad, like, oh, I'm so sorry this happened to you. Like,
yeah. Yes. Not outraged.
Sad, I'm sorry. Not outraged. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah. Way better.
So I'm going to talk about Otis Tool. And it's got to be something with this generation. Because my guy was born in 47.
Oh, good. I'm glad it's a certain generation and like, and not
late 40s. Jesus.
And did it happen around the 70s? Because I feel like the 70s were rocked with cannibals.
Early 80s. This was like around the same time as Dahmer.
Have you? Serial killers and cannibals in the 70s and 80s. It was just a theme. I don't know what they did.
Have you seen the theories on why, like, the 70s and everything were so prolific on, like, serial killers?
Lead poisoning?
Yes, there's a conspiracy theory that it was lead poisoning because lead was in paints. It was in paints and dishes, like, eating utensils. Like, everything was, like, lead-based. And it makes people lose their freaking minds.
Yeah.
And so they think that's why the 70s and 80s and, like, late 60s were rough times.
Yeah,
I really believe it on that part.
Yeah.
And I also believe it because if you look at like the amount of serial killers by country, it's disturbingly high in the US compared to the number two.
COVID cases, of, like, the COVID way mass that, shootings.
No, but I think it's serial killers.
Prison, incarceration.
I think it's the products we buy and like.
Yeah, oh yeah, we do it to ourselves. 100%.
It's like the lead in things that was in the 70s. Like, I think it has
like in the water
something like that. Literally, there's something in the water. Like real though.
Yeah, your water's flowing through lead pipes.
Yeah, look at Flint, Michigan. They still don't have clean water, right?
Oh jeez,
happened in Newark too.
Yeah.
I need to buy a water filter.
Oh, I heard about New York and how, like, they have to do bottles only right now.
Really? They're still under... Jersey City is a boil water advisor.
Yeah, so, like, the theaters on, like, the before the bridge, like, everything, like, just got tainted. So they can't use any of, like, tap water or anything.
Mm. I gotta invest in a filter.
Get a filter.
Yeah.
It's just a good call.
I gotta invest in a good filter. Like, I'm gonna... My top shelf filter is over here.
Get one that, like, attaches to your faucet.
But I need, like... Yeah,
no,
I need
get one of the, faucet. Like, good ones that, like, attaches to your faucet.
Yeah. My parents have one. I think I'm gonna...
Yeah.
Invest.
Just have them bring it with them.
Bring it with them from their old house. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're moving. You don't need this anymore.
Give me your over.
Yeah.
Mine. All right. So, Otis is best known for killing, I don't know if you, did either of you watch America's Most Wanted or did your parents watch America's Most Wanted?
My mom, you know, she likes her.
Okay.
ID.
Yeah, my mom too.
I did not, but I watched Milo and Otis.
Milo and Otis?
Not quite the same.
No, it's not a cat and a pug.
There is no cat. No. No orange tabbies.
But he did have a partner. That's kind of what's crazy. He did have a partner.
Was his name Milo?
No, his name was Henry.
Oh, damn it.
Could be a pet name easily. But Otis is best known for killing the host of America's Most Wanted. His name was John Walsh. He killed his son.
What?
Was one of his victims. Yeah. Yeah, that's what he's most known for. He's also known as the Jacksonville cannibal. Ooh. I believe he had a partner in crime who was also like his partner, like his romantic partner in real life, whose name was Henry Lee Lucas. Yeah.
Side note: when I was single and I would find out these crazy people had lovers and people who loved them, I would be like, "What the hell is wrong with me?"
Well, this guy also they were very much kindred spirits. They had a passion for killing people, so it just kind of worked.
These and crazy people can find love. I can too.
It's feeding off each other's energies. Like,
Ugh. Yeah.
And it's bad, though, too, because usually they're, like, sociopaths or psychopaths, so they can't, like, de-escalate the situation. They only, like, build each other up until, like, it fully, just, like, breaks down.
But Henry, unlike Otis, Henry did not have a taste for human flesh. He didn't
either. No, he did not.
No. Otis did, but Henry did not. He did not partake.
Oh, dear, I just saw a couple pictures, because I have to look them up immediately, and I
just this guy looks just...
Well, both of them.
Yeah, they look a little... Oh, yeah, yeah, exactly. So, oh, Otis is the bald one. just to paint the picture. Henry's the one with the full head of hair, and Otis is bald. So,
got it.
There you go. But nice, between the two of them, they committed, or they confessed to committing more than 100 murders.
You know what upsets me a lot? Sorry to interrupt you.
Mm-mm, you're fine.
Just thinking that the last thought were those faces that people saw. Like, some of these serial killers were absolutely terrifying, and just thinking that they were, like, the last experience anyone had, like, it's just...
Sorry. Yeah.
Apparently it was the last experience of hundreds of people.
Yes. Although Otis was only, like, proven to have killed 6 people. He confessed to killing more than 100.
Usual.
Yeah, per usual. So Otis grew up in Florida. Single parent household. His mother was abusive, extremely religious. His grandmother was a Satanist and actually used Otis to grave rob. So she would have him go out and rob bodies to use in satanic rituals. So that was his childhood, which was just, you know, setting this guy up for success.
Sounds normal. Not like the, like, satanic church that's, like...
The Church of Satan is very different
than the satanic that.
Yeah. The Church of Satan...
This was that.
Yeah. This is the one you think of when you think of the Church of Satan. But it's
Grandma had their grandchild robbing body parts.
Yeah. Yes. This was literal. This is literal.
But on the flip side... The nicest people you will ever meet are probably in the Church of Satan, because they're just humanists and moralists. That's all they are.
Yeah, this is not that. And they just
call themselves the Church of
Satan. Yeah, we need to clearly define it. This is not that.
No.
This is the crazy ones.
This is nothing to sneeze at.
Nice callback.
Bring it a full circle. Love it.
So is it a good thing? Like, what is it for? Is it like it's nothing to worry about? Is that what it means? Or
no, like nothing to scoff at, like nothing to just pass by. Like you want to pay attention to it. Like it's important.
I'm Googling.
Okay. So nothing to sneeze at, nothing to just go, oh. I don't know.
Something that is not inconsequential in matter and not a trifling thing. Does that clarify your questions?
I just
want to know
why sneeze, right?
Yeah.
Hopefully, while I look up the origins of
we're gonna fact check this phrase. Nothing to sneeze at.
Origin.
I need to look it up too to see, make sure that I'm just not crazy and that it is
the first use of this phrase was in 1799. It is not new.
But where?
And it was used in a play in Fortune's Frolic. By John Till Allingham. That is the origins, apparently. But I am not sure where the sneezing comes in.
It was literally just a script.
It should not be held... Something that should not be held in contempt is part of its origin story. It's an idiom. In case we didn't know that already.
Just
putting it out there. Just accept it. It's an idiom.
Please keep the typing in. That's such a good sound effect.
Nothing to be.
Oh, you like my keyboard?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a very clicky. It's nice. It's the American form of this idiom. BT dubs.
There you go. I don't even know what I'm typing.
Not to be sneezed at is its British form. For those of us across the pond.
I just don't think it made its way across the continental United States.
Probably not.
Maybe it only made its way on the East Coast and not the West Coast.
It stopped here.
I've just never heard of it before.
Or you're not cultured, Chelsea.
I mean, that too.
I'm kidding.
I mean, no, I'm not. I'm not very cultured at all.
Peach sangria is very strong.
It is. I almost need more. Got power food is first.
Yeah, all right. Let's stop interrupting Jackie.
Sorry.
Tangent.
That's extraordinaire.
Okay. My bullet points are still strong. So Otis, grave robbing Otis, committed his first murder at 14.
When you have a satanic mother helping you make you dig up bodies.
Right, so you already have that going on, and then this child, because he's a kid at this point, gets picked up by a traveling salesman and raped. And he runs the guy over with his car. So you know what? Fair.
Holy shit.
That one's fair.
Okay, we're in the early 80s here?
No, he's 14, so we're in the 60s.
Yeah, in the 60s. 50s, those are almost some 60s. Big-ass cars.
Yep. He ran them right over. After that, he becomes a drifter. So he just starts roaming around. And that's where he eventually meets Henry. So they link up. They go on this crime spree across a few different states. Murder spree, I shouldn't say crime spree. A murder spree over a few different states. And Lucas... Henry's last name was Lucas. So Henry recounted at some point that Otis would eat the ribs of his victims, often barbecuing them.
He got a good smoker, why not?
And he would often drink their blood. And he said he didn't partake in the cannibalism because he didn't like Otis's barbecue sauce.
Good reason, honestly. Barbecue sauce will make or break any meal. Like,
especially when it gets into human flesh. So he
didn't like his barbecue sauce.
Didn't like his barbecue sauce.
Okay. I will accept this as a plausible reason. For now.
So they go through their, like I said, they admitted to killing more than 100 people, never only got convicted of killing 6. And he was only caught because he got sloppy and emotional. He was caught on an arson charge after burning down his ex's house. So not Henry, but somebody else burned down the house with the guy inside. And that's how he was caught. So he went to
the guy inside.
Yep. And that's how he was caught.
Spiteful man.
Yeah. So now we're
spiteful man feelings.
Now we're in the 80s. So during the crime spree, one of his victims was a child. He picked the kid up in a Sears parking lot, lured him there with candy and toys, started driving. Kid very quickly figures out that something's not right, starts crying, wants to go home, punches the kid in the face, starts crying more. So it just starts beating the kid until he's unconscious. Then takes him to a secluded area. Decapitates him with a machete.
Oh, sweet Jesus.
Disposes of the torso.
No.
But forgets about the head. And leaves the head in the van for a few days. And when he finds it again, he disposes of the head. So this all happened, this all happened in the 80s. It was very well speculated during that time that the child was Adam Walsh, John Walsh's son. So
I was about to say, it sounds like the kid who got kidnapped.
Mm-hmm. So everyone believed that Otis was the killer, but they didn't actually link him officially to that murder until 2008. And at this point, Otis was already dead. He died in prison in 1996 of liver failure. But that was his most famous victim. It doesn't say whether he cannibalized Adam. I wasn't able to find anything about that, but that is the most famous of the murders that are linked to him. So that is Otis Toole. And then I texted you guys earlier, and I feel kind of bad bringing this up because, like, the honorary mention that I have, it by no means has been validated or even investigated in a legal sense, but I felt like if we were talking about cannibals, we couldn't bring up, we couldn't not bring up Armie Hammer.
Oh my god. Yes.
I was just thinking
that
about
blew
it.
My mind.
I googled it today because I realized now that since this all that news broke in March, nothing else has really happened. It's been silent. He's still under investigation with the LAPD for rape. He's back in rehab and has a new girlfriend. So does his ex-wife. Like, his ex-wife has moved on as well. But it's just, like, so weird.
I really liked Armie Hammer, too. Like, before all this happened.
I did, too. Me but too. Now, like, going back and, like, rewatching not even stuff he's been in, but, like, his interviews, I'm like,
Oh, I haven't watched his
been
interviews.
In a lot, though, that I've seen. I don't,
Man from
I didn't
Uncle,
watch
man.
That. The Man from Uncle is literally the only thing I've seen him in, yeah. I think.
Social Network?
Social Network.
I didn't see the Social Network.
He was in some Beauty and the Beast thing, wasn't he?
I don't remember. To IMDb. I remember Call Me By Your Name.
Yeah, I remember that too. I'm pretty sure he was at Lincoln at some point.
Oh, he was in Mirror, Mirror. That movie
you were in Danger.
Lily Collins, I think.
Yeah.
Phil Collins'
yeah,
daughter.
That was it.
Death on the Nile. Is
oh, they were
out
talking
in 2020.
He's like the main role, and they were talking about like if it was even possible for them to reshoot.
Yeah, he's
it.
Been completely blacklisted. He got dropped by his publicist. He got dropped by his agency. Studios are blacklisting him, and this is all based off of allegations. So,
how would he? I
but
don't
the allegations
see from
are
the
like,
trailer of Death on the Nile how he would even be. How they would even reshoot that movie.
They can't do it. They decided to leave him in it. And they're like, it's like too much. Especially since that movie, it's not going to earn that much back. Like, it might make.
Just drop it on
costs.
Disney Plus. Like, just put it on Disney Plus and call it a day.
Oh, it's Fox?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Disney's not going to put it's that shit
yeah,
on.
No.
They're
no.
not going to put that shit on Disney Plus if this guy's been accused of cannibalism.
What's their other? Hulu.
The drop parental
it on, put
backlash.
It on Hulu. Just yeah, put it on Hulu. It's fine. It'll be fine. It's not.
Didn't Disney say that? They're like, anything we don't want on Disney Plus is going to Hulu. So, like,
basically,
yeah, put
it's
it on
like
Hulu. Forget
it's
about
like
it.
It's like their
fine.
Unadvertised
it's
motto,
fine.
Right?
Put on Hulu. Yeah, that's crazy.
Wasn't that movie supposed to come out in 2020? Death on
yes.
the Nile.
Yeah,
it's okay.
To
it's
come
one
out
of those
holidays.
2020 movies.
Yeah.
Yep. It got pushed like a few different times, and now I imagine it's just gonna, it's either gonna get shelved and never see the light of day, or it's just gonna go to streaming.
I think we're going at the same time. You go.
It's an Agatha Christie book, isn't it?
Yeah
it's Agatha
yes.
Christie.
I've read the book.
Yeah.
I'm surprised they didn't I'm surprised that they didn't just release it during the holiday season, like. Because it's one of those movies that's not going to make a lot back. It's going to make production costs, maybe. Like,
well,
it's
that was before all this news broke. Like, now, you got no shot. Like, you just need to, you got to recoup some money, so put it somewhere.
Yeah. Well, maybe what they're hoping, because, I mean, I kind of forgot about Armie Hammer, so maybe that they were, like, hoping, like, just goes under
the rug. I didn't realize he was
in
that one, though.
I didn't either.
I love Agatha Christie. Like, I wanted to see this movie.
I still might watch it. I'm just going to watch it. Like,
because
you know what else he was in, too? He was in Rebecca. And if you haven't read that book, it's about a husband that kills his wife and gets away with it.
Oh. Fitting. Life imitates art, right?
Rebecca is, like, one
it's
of those
dark.
It's well, dark. Have you seen the Alfred Hitchcock one?
No.
Okay. Watch the Alfred Hitchcock movie of this. I've read the book. I mean,
he plays the husband.
It's not a rewatchable, I'll put it that way.
Rebecca is not a rewatchable. Unless
it's not a rereadable either.
It's not a rereadable either. I've watched it several times because I had to do a paper on it because I took an Alfred Hitchcock class.
We had to read Rebecca as part of an English class. I read it. I was like, done with that. And we're going to put that there. Thank you.
Yeah. Like, I'm not saying, it is peak Alfred Hitchcock cinema. So yeah. If you like,
that's the perfect Alfred content Hitchcock, for him. Yeah.
It's really good. And the score.
Yeah. I guess
that. Is very Alfred Hitchcock. So I like it for that reason. I've written so many papers on it, but I'm mad.
Oh, but I feel like I should clarify. Like, I mentioned Armie Hammer, just kind of assuming that everybody who listens knows what is up with this guy. So Armie Hammer is, if you don't know who he is, he's an actor. We've already mentioned a few things that he's been in. This was back last summer?
Yeah, it was like
last fall, like about a year ago almost, actually.
Was it that long ago?
Yeah, some accusations started popping up on social media from one of his ex-girlfriends that he's very violent sexually. He has some kinks, including cannibalism and wanting to eat her flesh and drink her blood and things like that. So all of that emerges. And then it's validated by a few other women who said that they had also similar experiences with him.
Yeah.
And it all kind of culminates into this one woman. Her name is Effie. She files a criminal complaint with Los Angeles Police Department for rape. So he is currently being actively investigated for a rape charge. But as social media does, all these wild rumors just started flying around that he's a cannibal and he's murdered people, and his family, he comes from a very, very wealthy family. His grandfather had a history of being abusive sexually and emotionally, so that there is history there in his family.
He was working construction, right? And they found...
Yes, that was the one. He was during... this was during shutdown. He supposedly was working a construction site. And at that construction site, they found human remains. But nothing, if you look into that, there's not... That's a dead end. Nothing has come out of that. So that's probably... Hopefully just wild accusations, but...
Yeah, and not kink shaming anyone. As long as it's consensual on both sides, you do right. you. As long as you're not you.
But this was not
hurting or severely that. That
this was.
It
not
was
that.
Definitely a one sided kink.
Yes.
It's a one sided kink. He was married from 2010 to 2020.
Has kids too.
He has kids.
Yeah. He's got young kids. Yeah, he's got young kids.
Oh dear.
I hope they're in therapy. Even if Armie Hammer is innocent of all things, it can't be easy to have.
Oh, he's gonna definitely if it turns out that all this is BS, he probably already needs.
I think he's done, right?
Well, he's in rehab right now.
Yeah, but he's rehab. Done acting for sure.
From a PR standpoint, no, there you cannot come back from this. This is the worst case scenario. Whether it be true or false, it's out there already. Yeah.
Forget it being done. False.
Yeah, and he might have had a chance had he not been dropped by literally everybody. His publicist went goodbye.
Nope.
Agency went nope. That's not a good sign.
And he's so, traditionally beautiful, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Movie star looks.
And he's, super tall. I have that thing, just because I'm so tall, that I'm, almost automatically attracted to anyone taller than me.
yes, we know.
Remember that guy on the train?
We know. The guy on the subway.
You're so beautiful.
The guy on the subway?
I didn't even see his horizontal.
This guy on the subway was so tall that he had to
he had to
put his head on his own shoulder
to fit in the subway car. And if you've ever been in a subway car, you know, I mean, I have feet away from
the ceilings aren't like very low. They're normal.
Yeah.
They're normal.
Yeah. And so this man was so tall, and Chelsea and I were like, a man for Chelsea.
Immediately. We found her someone. Hooray.
Any NBA players or friends of NBA players that listen to the pod, Chelsea need a man.
If you like tall, thick ladies, let me know.
Oh. Cannibals.
Yeah. Oh, cannibals,
man.
What
a fun topic.
Right? That was...
it was more fun with wine and friends, yes. Because when I was just researching myself, it got very dark.
Yeah,
got very dark. Up. We should have researched together because it was a struggle, man.
Yeah. Thank you, Chelsea, for providing the wholesome
You're story welcome. Between.
Yeah, the
between. Between all the literal depravity.
I have an option for our next episode that might give leeway to more fun options.
Okay.
Is that choose an event in history or a person in history that inspired a movie or a TV show.
Oh,
or some sort of
so much.
Or some sort of like fictional thing that happened. Like, you know, Vlad the Impaler.
This will be right? fun. I like that.
That is so up our alley.
So, perfect.
It should be good.
I'm excited for it.
Yes.
Yeah,
that's the
good.
Next episode.
That'll be good.
There's a lot of options and a lot of fun ones.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. No, I mean, there are so many options.
Yes.
This can be amazing. It's I mean, we had two just in this podcast.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah.
So the choices.
The choices are
many. The choices are many.
Yeah.
Yeah. The choices are many. Very exciting. Okay.
Down.
Well, that's all for this episode. Follow us on our Instagram at Tipsy Depraved Podcast if you want the recipes to our drinks to every episode. You'll find them there. And we'll see you next time with that cool topic that Chelsea picked for us. Woo-hoo. Bye-bye.
Bye.